Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel, maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are black gold, black gold. You are.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Allie Irving for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Oprah Daily. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Daily. The first article is called, I Couldn't Find Enough Books That Joyfully Represented My Children, So I Wrote Them Myself. Black history belongs on our shelves, but I also wanted bedtime stories filled with laughter, mischief, and everyday magic. This article was written by Clotilde Ewing, and this was originally published February 4th, 2026. Some first-time parents get excited to buy the crib and the baby clothes. I was excited to build my kids their first library. I remember so clearly how books opened new worlds for me and was reminded how picture books can take you anywhere, from the most whimsical lands of make-believe to the quiet, ordinary moments of everyday life. But when it came time to buy my kids' books, I realized it wasn't going to be as simple as walking into my local bookstore. Much of what I saw on the stands in the mid-2010s when my son and daughter were born featured either farm animals or families that didn't resemble ours, black, middle class, and living in modern times. The experience took me back to some of my favorite childhood books and series, from Amelia Bedelia and Nancy Drew to The Babysitter's Club. I realized that in my earlier years, with few exceptions, I grew up alongside characters who didn't look like me, or in some small but important ways, live like me. Let's face it, when kids are the sidekicks in someone else's story, or most often only get to show up in certain stories or roles, they may not fall asleep as the stars in their own dreams. I went out of my way to track down books that were more reflective of my kids' worlds than the titles I grew up with. I researched on my own and got suggestions from friends. Through that work, I found titles online like Max and the Tagalong Moon by Floyd Cooper, Whistle for Willie by Ezra Jack Keats, and Octopus Hug by Lawrence Pringle to go along with widely available books like Goodnight Moon, Blueberries for Sal, and Where the Wild Things Are. While I ultimately put together a great book collection for both of my kids, it took more work than I expected to find books that reflected my precocious kids and our black family. I was annoyed, maybe even mad, but I was also an overtired working mother who had mostly figured it out for the time being. But then, when my kids were about 2 and 4, I came across an article titled She Wants More Than MLK at Bedtime by Deneen Milner and felt both seen and unsettled. The article called out a truth many of us had long experienced. Diversity in children's books is still lacking, and when black children are represented, their stories are often framed through overcoming struggle or attaining excellence. There aren't enough stories where black kids can simply be kids. I cut the article out and placed it on my vision board. I thought about the stories about Juneteenth, the civil rights movement, and books celebrating black trailblazers like Jackie Robinson or Mae Jemison that were on my kids' shelves and that were frankly a lot easier to find on trips to my local bookstore than books like Octopus Hug, a charming book about family and play between a father and his kids. While inspiring in many ways, they are heavy. I hope for my kids that their lives aren't all about overcoming struggle or stigma. While we talk about our country's history and heroes in our house, when my kids go to bed, I want them channeling their imaginations and seeing themselves as the stars of stories and adventures, not carrying the weight of the world when they drift off to dream. Looking back, I recognize now that I was experiencing a shift of sorts. Though I have always been proud of being black, I gave equal, if not more, significance to being a woman. However, becoming a mom to two beautiful children sparked something in me and made me fiercely protective of their identities and right to be seen fully. I wasn't just a mother, I was a Black mother who had the honor and responsibility to raise Black children in a world that wasn't set up to fully see them beyond their race. After years of bemoaning the absence of rich, playful narratives that featured Black children, I decided to write a story of my own. My debut children's book, Stella Keeps the Sun Up, was my vision board come to life through a precocious, funny kid who happens to be Black. As I worked to develop the character that would become Stella, named after my own daughter, I thought about some of the relatable experiences we had in our house. Wanting to delay bedtime, or fast forward a few years to hang out with the big kids, for example, are universal childhood yearnings, not experiences relegated to kids of a particular race or gender. While seeing a Black character as the star in those kinds of stories wouldn't seem like much to some, for others it says, you belong in this world too. While I wanted Stella to be relatable to all children, I needed her to specifically and authentically depict girls like my daughter, with beautiful brown skin and tight curls. I knew that one potential editor wasn't a fit for the project when she said that she could envision Stella with her hair flying in the wind. My kid's hair doesn't fly in the wind. It was such a throwaway comment, but it made me realize how important it was to work with people who understood instinctively all the little details that made Stella, Stella, that made children like her feel not just represented, but known. That conviction led me to my publisher and editor, Deneen, the author of the New York Times article that set me on my path to writing. It felt divine. I don't think I can ever quite describe what it was like to see my words brought to life by Lynn Gaines, whose illustrated version of Stella bursts with joy and bounces off the page with her signature afro puffs. And the feeling of gratitude that I receive when moms send me pictures of their beaming daughters dressed up as Stella for character day at school, thanking me for creating a fun protagonist who looks like their girls. Inspired by my own children, I wrote for all children, but I'm still moved by one of the great, unanticipated joys of becoming an author, witnessing firsthand what happens when a child feels seen in a book. When I see a little Black girl lingering at the end of a school visit or going in for a hug when I am at the door giving high fives, I know that stepping into the unknown was worth it. On my nightstand, I keep a toy flower that a young girl gifted me after one such school reading. It's a reminder that with a few hundred words and a good bit of hustle, I've given her and other kids a little more chance to grow into adults who believe they belong. The next article is called This is What a Trauma-Informed Workplace Looks Like. When I suffered a personal tragedy, my bosses showed up for me in exactly the right way. Here's how all leaders can do the same. This article was written by Michelle Horde and originally published February 3rd, 2026. We keep asking people to be human everywhere except at work, where grief is supposed to stay personal and trauma is expected to wait until after business hours. But trauma doesn't punch a time clock. It travels in the body. It lives in the nervous system, and when the whole self is carrying something heavy, the workplace doesn't get an unaffected version of that person. It gets whatever is left after the body has nearly depleted itself, trying to survive. Sometimes, what reactivates that survival response isn't even personal news. It's public news. Big national headlines that dominate feeds and conversation. A tragic story breaks and suddenly a colleague who has lived through violence, loss, or crisis isn't just reading the news. They're reliving parts of their own story, not because they want to, but because the brain and body remember. And right now, people are carrying far more than we can see. The American Psychological Association's Stress in America 2025, a Crisis of Connection report, describes a widespread emotional strain tied to loneliness and disconnection, and links isolation and societal division to real impacts on health and day-to-day functioning. In other words, when a rupture happens, whether personal or public, it harms an already compromised system. For me, this isn't just theory. It's my lived experience. When my daughter was murdered in 2017, I worked at Comcast NBC Universal. What I remember most, beyond the shock, beyond the fog, was the kindness of my bosses and colleagues, the attention to detail, the things done not by the book, but by the heart. And right now, people are carrying far more than we can see. Our leadership team made a decision that still moves me. They enlisted the company's special events and security teams to handle my daughter's funeral. These were the people who executed high-profile events, who had helped plan moments as massive as the Olympics. They created a meticulous plan so that one of the most difficult days of my life, saying goodbye to my child publicly, would be insulated from the media. They didn't just nail the logistics. They gave me protection, dignity. It was leadership saying, "We will hold the perimeter so you can fall apart safely inside it." Before I returned to the office, my boss suggested something just as humane. Each of my direct reports came to spend a day with me at home, one by one. We had time to connect, to cry, to tell the truth, and then, gently, to segue back into work. Not because the pain was gone, but because we were honoring what had happened while still finding a way forward. That is what trauma-informed leadership is made of. Presence, structure, and care that shows up in the details. Because trauma rarely announces itself. It slips in sideways. It manifests as fog and exhaustion, as irritability or numbness, as a high performer suddenly struggling to answer emails, as someone who looks fine while their nervous system is in freefall. In my current work as a leadership coach and consultant, I have seen how quickly good people misread these signals. They assume someone has a motivation problem when it's a nervous system problem. They interpret withdrawal as disengagement when someone is barely keeping it together. But a trauma-informed workplace doesn't ask, "What's wrong with you?" It asks, "What do you need to function with dignity right now?" It's not lowered expectations. It's leadership designed to provide explicit support in the form of bereavement leave, schedule flexibility, temporary workload adjustments, and clear access to mental health resources without making people beg or perform their pain to earn care. And it's replacing vagueness with specificity. I can take A or B off your plate. What would help most? Do you want me to lean in close right now or give you more space? What do you want shared and what do you want held? Sometimes the most powerful act is simply building a bridge back, because people don't return to work the same person they were before. They're learning how to live in a world that has changed shape. A trauma-informed workplace understands that the goal isn't normal. It's staying employed, connected, and intact while one's life is being remade. So when managers ask me, how do I support someone without smothering them? How do I show care without turning grief into a management project? I always offer the same counsel. Be close enough to help, far enough to let them breathe, and lean in when safety or functioning is at risk. Specifically, I suggest the following. Do. Reduce someone's workload quickly if they're overwhelmed. I'm pausing non-urgent work. I'll cover X and Y this week. Coordinate logistics, leave, travel, HR, concretely. Here are two options. We can decide today or tomorrow. Protect the perimeter. Shut down gossip, stop intrusive questions, and control what's shared. Don't ask for details to satisfy curiosity. Confuse support with constant contact. Just as important is stepping back when a colleague signals that they need space or privacy. Do. If they can't talk, respect it. No need to reply. I'm here. I'll check in on Thursday. If questions visibly overwhelm them, stop probing. We don't have to discuss details. Let's focus on what you need at work this week. If they want privacy, ground it in consent. What do you want shared and what do you want held? Don't disappear after one check-in. Make them manage your discomfort. And finally, when in doubt, these four lines are always appropriate. I'm so sorry I'm here. Do you want me to lean in close right now or give you more space? What would make work feel survivable this week? Here's what I'll do, and here's when I'll check back in. Ultimately, a trauma-informed workplace is simply a workplace that recognizes reality and chooses to lead with dignity. Because the question isn't whether trauma will show up at work. The question is whether leadership will. Michelle D. Hoard is a creative leader, executive coach, and award-winning author of The Other Side of Yet. She also contributes to Help Texts, a messaging platform that offers practical support for grief and major life transitions. The next article is called Turning the Tide, How One Designer is Using Seaweed to Fight Plastic Pollution. This article was written by J.J. Ramberg and originally published February 9, 2026. As a child growing up along California's Monterey Bay, Julia Marsh spent her days exploring tide pools, swimming in the ocean, and wandering through swaying kelp forests. Now, as co-founder of Sway, a startup with a bold vision for a plastic-free future, her early love of the sea has evolved into a mission to halt the flood of plastic choking our oceans. We need materials that heal, Julia says plainly. Nature holds the solutions. We just have to build the systems and tell the stories that bring these solutions to life. Seeing an opportunity. With a background in design, Julia spent years working in product packaging, where she discovered a grim truth. Package design is about making plastic look good, and much of that plastic turns into waste. Each year, 11 million metric tons of plastic waste flow into oceans, harming marine life and weakening the ocean's ability to capture carbon. Without change, this pollution could nearly triple by 2040. She also realized that 80% of a product's environmental impact is set at the design stage. Designers have a unique power to shift entire systems, she says. Regeneration became my obsession. What if packaging didn't just reduce harm, but actually restored life? The promise of seaweed. Seaweed found me early on, Julia says, recalling her days as a kid on the beach, using kelp as a jump rope. It grows quickly, needs no fresh water or pesticides, and thrives on coastlines worldwide. She and her co-founder, Matt Mays, set off on a journey from California to Peru, meeting with farmers and scientists to understand how seaweed could fuel a new materials revolution. They witnessed seaweed's unique ability to capture carbon, create marine habitats, and boost biodiversity, offering benefits conventional plastics can't touch. Designing for a regenerative future. Sway's mission is to design everyday materials that bring positive social and environmental value. We don't see the ocean as a victim, Julia says. We see it as the hero. The company developed packaging made from seaweed-based material that matches plastic's flexibility and strength, yet fully composts at home. Their secret? Thermoplastic seaweed. After hundreds of trial and error formulations, they cracked this breakthrough. Seaweed that melts and flows through plastic manufacturing without burning or breaking. Oceans, communities, and partnership. Sway sources seaweed responsibly, working with everyone from ocean farmers in Indonesia to kelp growers in Maine to people in Puerto Rico looking to repurpose invasive seaweed. Every supplier is vetted for ecological impact and community benefit. Our goal is resilient, climate-adapted jobs for coastal families, seaweed farming that uplifts rather than exploits, says Julie. She adds, change moves at the speed of culture. We can't work alone. Success depends on community. To grow that community, she's forging partnerships that help build an army of advocates to shift perspectives and drive change. Last year, Sway presented at Progression 2025, a gathering of founders, investors, and mission-driven brands focused on ocean conservation and climate solutions. They were also recently named a Time Best Invention of 2025. The road ahead. Looking forward, Julia imagines a world where Sway's seaweed materials are as common as plastic bags. Imagine every pouch or wrapper actually healing the ocean, she says. That's the dream. Not just less harm, but active good. She knows the urgency of rethinking packaging materials. 150,000 plastic bags are made every second, but also understands systemic change takes time. The momentum is real. Every partner, every customer, every coastal farmer adds to this movement. After all, synthetic plastics were created and scaled in just one century. With today's technology and awareness, it's time for a new chapter. The last article for today is called Wait, Are Itchy Ears a Sign of Perimenopause? Amy Poehler dropped this factoid on her podcast this week. We talked to a doctor to get some answers. This article was written by Sophia Lodato and originally published January 23rd, 2026. There's nothing like a casual mention of perimenopause to shift the vibe of an entire conversation, something Jennifer Lawrence learned herself in a recent appearance on the podcast Good Hang with Amy Poehler. While discussing Lawrence's new film, the actress paused mid-sentence to scratch at her ears. "Sorry, the inside of my ears are itchy. Is this gross?" she asked. "Well, itchy ears are a sign of menopause, so congrats," Poehler said with a smile. Cue J-Law's jaw dropping to the floor. Our interest was certainly piqued as well. There are many, many symptoms that can crop up during the change, from hot flashes and night sweats to things like chin hair and brain fog. But itchy ears? This wasn't something we'd heard before, so we had to investigate. Spoiler alert, Poehler isn't wrong. But like all things menopause, it's a bit more complicated. There is evidence that all over itchiness can be triggered by perimenopause. That's because estrogen supports skin health by improving blood flow and maintaining skin thickness, hydration, and elasticity, says Mindy Goldman, MD, the chief clinical officer at Midi Health and a clinical professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Science at the University of California, San Francisco. As estrogen levels fluctuate and decline during the menopause transition, your skin becomes thinner, drier, more sensitive, and more prone to itching. Whether itchy ears are an official perimenopause symptom remains to be seen, as we currently lack scientific studies or data that point to itchy ears being caused by the change. But anecdotal evidence suggests it's a thing. At Midi Health, it is not uncommon that our patients report itchy ears, says Dr. Goldman. Why? Ear canals have minimal tissue, a limited ability to retain moisture, and rely on earwax for lubrication and protection, she explains. Combine that with perimenopause's wicked ability to dry everything out, and that's a recipe for the big itch. So what on earth do we do when we want to scratch our ears off? First, you'll want to rule out things like allergies or other skin conditions. The latter usually comes with a rash, but talk to your doctor to confirm. And keep an eye on other potential menopause symptoms. If ear itchiness is happening at the same time as period changes, sleep problems, skin problems, increased anxiety, or any of a wide variety of perimenopause or menopausal symptoms, it's likely time to have a conversation with a menopause professional, says Dr. Goldman. To soothe the itch, Dr. Goldman also suggests avoiding cotton swabs or Q-tips, limiting over-cleaning of the ears, and using a few drops of mineral or olive oil to moisturize the ear canal. If the itching is particularly persistent, painful, or comes with any hearing changes or discharge, see your doctor before anything else. And fear not, Jennifer Lawrence. Estrogen also drops for several months postpartum, and breastfeeding keeps it on the lower side. So you may not be in para territory quite yet. But when you are, we're here with all the information you need to get through it. Looks like we've got time for one last short article, Oprah on the Bliss of a Bookstore. In a world that asks us to move faster and consume more, a bookstore gently insists on the opposite. This article is by Oprah Winfrey, originally published February 8, 2026. Hey there, insiders. A few weeks ago, I visited the McNally Jackson Bookstore in New York City's Rockefeller Center to sign copies of my new book, Enough, which I co-wrote with Dr. Anya Jastreboff. It was thrilling to see it alongside works by so many authors I deeply admire. But even more moving was the experience of being in an independent bookshop. The welcoming maze of eye-catching covers, the quiet hum of people browsing, lingering, and discovering great reads. When I lived in Chicago, there was a great bookstore right across the street from me, and one of my favorite Sunday rituals was spending hours there, reading titles and flipping through pages. Sometimes I left with a stack. Sometimes I left with a single sentence in my head that stayed with me all week. I always left feeling nourished. Bookstores are more than places to buy books. They are invitations to slow down, to listen, to remember that ideas unfold best when we give them room to breathe. In a world that asks us to move faster and consume more, a bookstore gently insists on the opposite. It says, take your time. Trust your curiosity. Let yourself wander and be surprised. Looking for something cozy to do today? I suggest you try my Sunday ritual and see what calls to you. You might read the exact words you didn't know you needed. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Daily. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Allie Irving, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Oprah Daily is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel, maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you